All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am answering your listener questions about the Falcons. We're going to be talking about fixing the offensive line. We're going to be talking about play callers, all sorts of stuff.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman. Been covering the Falcons for many years, over a decade at FalcFans.com, one of the longest running Falcon websites on the internet. Of course, I'm on Twitter at FalcFans, and I am the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today is another Q&A episode. We're going to be talking a lot of questions, a lot of great questions this week. So let's jump right into it. Or before we jump right into it, for those of you, you know, who aren't regular listeners or listening for the first time, people send these questions to me on Facebook, Locked On Falcons. They send them to the Twitter page, Locked On Falcons. They send them to my Twitter, which is at FalcFans, of course. They email them to me, LockedOnFalcons@mail.com, as well as leaving comments at FalcFans.com where the podcast is posted daily. And you can, too, if you want to submit questions for future Q&As. You can submit them anytime. I usually send out, you know, tweet something or post something on Facebook during the middle of the week to get prepared for the end of the week Q&As. But you can send them whenever you come up with a question that you want answered. Just go ahead and hit that send button on whatever various platform you decide to do so. So without any further ado, let's jump right into it. Joe Morgan asks, what's more important to the team's future success, O-line or D-line? Who are some potential prospects in our draft range we should be looking at? I would say, you know, right now, let's just assume Nick Bosa, Quinnen Williams, and Ed Oliver are off the board when the Falcons are drafting. They're currently slated to pick six. I think there's a very high probability. I think there's virtually no chance that Bosa or Quinnen Williams last that long. I think there's a decent chance that Oliver could last that long. But let's just take him out of the equation for the time being. I think, you know, looking at the prospects, probably D-tackle, Jeffrey Simmons, Raekwon Davis, Rashawn Gary are sort of the consensus next group of guys. But, you know, you could argue for me that, oh, those guys could get drafted. Some of those guys could get drafted as high as like pick 7 or 8, but also could fall all the way to the 20s in the first round. I could see that happening as well, depending on, you know, what happens at the combine and potential senior bowls and all that sorts of stuff. I know Simmons has an off-field thing that probably will knock him down the board quite a bit, even though I think he's talented enough to be a top 10 pick, but or at least certainly a top 15 pick, but probably won't go in the top 15. At edge rusher, I think Josh Allen from Kentucky, Cleveland Farrell, and Brian Burns are typically the next group of clustered at the top. I think Josh Allen is probably the likeliest to go in the top 10. But again, I think similar to those D tackles, I could also see a scenario where one or all of those guys fall into the 20s. On the offensive line, Jonah Williams is really the only guy that I consistently hear being talked about as a potential top 10 offensive tackle. I know some people put Greg Little up there. You know, nothing put past the NFL because Eric Flowers was a top 10 pick, and Greg Little reminds me a lot of Eric Flowers, although I actually like Greg Little, but I think he's super raw in a similar way that Eric Flowers was. So I wouldn't be shocked if Greg Little went very high as well. But, you know, I think Jonah Williams is probably the only guy. To answer your second question, I could probably do an entire podcast devoted to that, but I will try to answer your question as succinctly as I can. I would probably say the offensive line, because I'm assuming that when you say future success, you're talking about competing for and winning a Super Bowl. And I'd also add to that my personal belief that in order to do that, you have to be quote unquote elite at something, which is, you know, my definition of elite is being in the conversation for being the best in the league at that. And I think, you know, the area of the Falcons roster that is closest to currently being elite is the offense. And thus the argument would be that improving the offensive line will do more to help get that unit potentially over the hump than necessarily improving the defensive line is going to turn that suddenly into an elite defense. But I do think there are a little bit of caveats to that, because I also happen to think that play calling sort of can trump personnel, and particularly with the offensive line play. For example, if you were putting things on a 10-point scale with 5 being average, if you say the Falcons have a 8 or 9 at quarterback and 8 at their skill positions, maybe a 9 as well, and suddenly can improve their offensive line to be an 8 there as well, but your play caller is like a 5 or a 6, I still think more often than not come January in the postseason, you're going to find your team coming up pretty short when things happen. Because I think you're going to more often than not run across a defense that has 8s or 9s across the board. And they're going to be able to nullify your offensive talent. And then that's going to put the focus on the coaching. And if you're only a 6 there or a 5 there, the odds aren't necessarily in your favor that the other team is also going to be a 5 or a 6. That's sort of the simplest way I can sort of explain it. So while I think, you know, with an improved offensive line, the Falcons can certainly be a perennial playoff contender, and using the example I just used, I still remain skeptical whether or not that team is sort of, is, you know, that team that has 8s across the board but then has a 6 as a play caller is really a team that's on the verge of winning Super Bowls. And I think that's, you know, that's an argument that I think people can make, a compelling argument to justify the Falcons getting rid of Sark. And I certainly understand that argument. I don't really disagree with that argument one bit. But I also don't think it's like automatic that, oh, if you fire Sark, the next guy is going to come in and be significantly better than that. That's, you know, that you're going to find a guy that's going to be a 7 or an 8 or better as a play caller. Because when I've been following the Falcons pretty closely for like 20 years, going back to the late 90s and the Dan Reeves years, and they've had about 10 play callers in that period of time. And I would literally say 9 out of 10 of those guys weren't better than 6s. I think Kyle Shanahan was the only guy that was better than 6, and we only got 1 year of him being better than the 6. If you're basically saying his performance in 2015, or at least the offense's performance in 2015, was looked like a 6. You know, you probably have, you know, you could probably take Cutter or Malarkey or Knapp's best year, or and certainly Sark's best year, maybe, or at least best half of a season, and say he was better than the 6 and maybe push him to a 7, but you never got that consistently. So I don't necessarily buy into sort of the expectation, oh, you fire Sark and your problems go away. Like, you fire Sark and more than likely you're just probably going to wind up making a lateral move based off of the Falcons' history, where 90% of their play callers haven't been significantly better than Sark, in my humble opinion. All right, we got more to talk about, particularly with these offensive coordinators, but I want to let you guys know about Action Heat, who makes the world's best battery-heated clothing. With Action Heat, you can control your environment and have heat on demand at a touch of a button. Action Heat clothing is engineered to safely and efficiently deliver heat via heating panels, similar to what you might find in a heated car seat. Action Heat clothes can reach temperatures of up to 135 degrees and are powered by rechargeable 5-volt lithium-ion batteries that can also be used to recharge your phone and any other gadgets you may be carrying while you're wearing these Action Heat clothes. Action Heat clothes are perfect for both friends and family on your holiday gift list. They're great for anybody that loves the outdoors, works in the outdoors, skis, snowboards, or anybody that just hates being cold. And certainly this time of year, that makes a lot of sense. Action Heat clothes are available for men and women and have great new styles just released for this winter season. You can find jackets, socks, gloves, hats, and even undergarments. There's a special offer for our Locked On listeners where you can save 20% off your entire order by going to actionheat.com/lockedon to check out everything they have to offer. Again, that's actionheat.com/lockedon, or use the coupon code LOCKEDON at checkout to save 20% off your entire order. Make all your winter activities a blast with a blast of warmth from Action Heat, the perfect solution to keep you warm and toasty this winter. All right, Interwoven One, aka the hero we reserve on Twitter, as Knapp isn't likely. Kubiak's health will probably keep him away from the OC position. Bevel apparently didn't interview well. Is John DeFilippo the guy for the offensive coordinator spot? I read he ran a partial zone scheme or something. Can you flesh that out and your thoughts on him as a possible offensive coordinator? I did talk about him a little bit yesterday, but to be honest with you, I don't know enough about DeFilippo to give you sort of the definitive answers that you may be seeking. All I know is that he succeeded Kyle Shanahan back in Cleveland in 2015 when Shanahan left to come to Atlanta and didn't do a great job of utilizing Taylor Gabriel that year. Then he went to Philadelphia as a quarterback's coach for 2 years, was instrumental in developing Wentz to a point where he was basically the front runner to be the MVP last season before he got hurt, and also sort of getting Nick Foles to be, you know, a good version of Nick Foles to win the Eagles team the Super Bowl last year. What I'll say about this Eagles offense, it's a two tight end based offense. I mentioned on a recent podcast where there's two versions of the Shanahan offense, one run by Kyle Shanahan, which features a high usage of fullbacks and multiple tight end sets. And the other one is the Sean McVay version, which is exclusively three wide receiver sets. Philadelphia doesn't run a Shanahan version of the West Coast offense. It's from the Andy Reid branch of the West Coast offense. They all stem, if you go back far enough, from Bill Walsh in the late 70s and early 80s. But, you know, it's a little different. With Andy Reid and Doug Peterson and John Gruden coming from the Holmgren sect, while Kyle Shanahan and McVay and those guys are more sort of from the Mike Shanahan branch of that. But, you know, I know Minnesota ran a zone scheme last year, and I didn't watch enough of their offense this year, but I'm assuming that they continued to run a lot of zone this year. Under DeFilippo, I know Philadelphia runs a healthy amount of outside zone. I know that's a significant component of the Andy Reid offense historically. So I'm assuming that he would be pretty comfortable. He never coached with Kyle Shanahan. He came over from Oakland when he went to Cleveland. He did spend, he did two separate stints as a quarterback coach under Greg Knapp when Greg Knapp was an offensive coordinator in 2008 and 2012 in Oakland. He also was there in 08 when Lane Kiffin was the head coach, who you can recall, you know, sort of was the predecessor to Sark at USC and ran a version of sort of this West Coast outside zone scheme. So for me with DeFilippo, you know, other than sort of just reading you off his Wikipedia pages, I just did. The thing with him is people I respect from Eagles media had very high praise of him during his stint there, and when he left this offseason. And, you know, that to me, as I said on yesterday's podcast, is intriguing. So if he does come here, I'll probably have some smart people that I know that cover the Browns and the Eagles and the Vikings come on the podcast to have more informed opinions about him, to give those thoughts, and then I'll probably sit down and watch some film of his offenses over the past couple of years and sort of give additional thoughts from my own. But I'll only basically do that if he winds up getting a gig here. So, you know, the pessimist in me is basically saying, like, you know, I like this movie, or I potentially like this movie. I find it both intriguing and compelling. But because of that, you know, the Falcons aren't going to do that because they always find ways to break my heart. Our next question is on a similar note from Riley Street. What are your thoughts on the dot connecting people have done with Daryl Bevel? I read an article today that had a graphic of his offenses ranked in both points and overall yards for all his years in both Seattle and Minnesota. Doesn't our offense move the ball significantly better and even score better right now than the 15th or 16th in the league, which is what he finished most years? He only finished in the top 10 in league in yards 3 out of 12 years and scoring 4 out of 12. Right now, we're 10th in points and I'm sure better in yards. And if I remember correctly, we moved the ball better last year than that as well. What would interest us in a scheme that would seemingly slow down our offense? Are his points per drive significantly higher or something? Well, to answer that last question, yes, his points per drive are significantly higher, particularly in that 2012 to 2015 range where he was in Seattle. Seattle finished in the top 10 every year in points per drive. Historically, Bevel's offenses have been primarily run-based with those 4 years in Seattle that I just mentioned. They finished in the top 7 in rushing DVOA, in large part thanks to Marshawn Lynch, as well as coupling that with sort of Russell Wilson's ability to extend plays and use his legs. And, you know, during his time in Minnesota, four out of those 5 years he was in Minnesota, he had a young Adrian Peterson. So I think, you know, the positive you can say about Bevel's offense, both in Seattle and Minnesota, is that in the years when they were clicking, they were among the more explosive offenses in the league. Seattle didn't throw the ball a lot, but you saw those big plays generated off of their play-action passing game, the ability of Wilson to, you know, do Russell Wilson things, extending plays and just heaving up bombs to Doug Baldwin and Tyler Lockett, among others. You know, he had Brett Favre for 2 years, his last 2 years in Minnesota. Brett Favre was there in that 09 season when the Vikings went all the way to the NFC Championship game and lost to the Saints, you know, in the infamous Bounty Bowl. You know, they were a very explosive offense, but but they were pretty bad in 2010. Not because they weren't explosive, but largely due to the sheer amount of interceptions that Brett Favre threw that year. He threw like 19, and I think the Vikings had like 26 interceptions that year. So there's just no way to be a productive offense when you turn your ball over that much. I think the one big concern you have with Bevel is that basically from the eight seasons from 2007 to 2014, he had either Adrian Peterson or Marshawn Lynch spearheading his offense, guys at the time who were widely considered to be, if not the best, then the top two or three running backs in the league. And one wonders that whether or not Devontae Freeman can sort of revert to that. We've seen stretches of seasons where Devontae Freeman has been that guy, but usually never for more than five or six games in a row. And you wonder if Devontae doesn't come back and return to that form and do that over the course of an entire season, does Bevel's offense work to the same degree as it did in some of those years? You couple that with the fact that when you have an offense that's focused around running the football, that then puts a little bit of added pressure on your defense to be at a play at a high level. And we know that the Falcons under Dan Quinn haven't really ever had that type of defense, because, you know, the reason for that is because you're going to play some number of low scoring games where you're trying to run the football. And you're not going to drop 38 points when you're running the football, you know, 30, 40 times, or typically you're not going to do that. And what was interesting about Seattle was they won a lot of games. They won more games than any team in the NFL from 2012 to 2015, where they scored 20 or less points. They won 64% of those games during that 4-year span. While the average NFL team during that 4-year period only won about 21% of those games. And if you look at the difference between those win percentages, and assume you take away the Seattle's great defense in those years and put an quote-unquote average defense in their stead, the difference between those win totals is about 10 wins for the Seahawks, which is basically 2.5 wins per season, to where the defense basically won them games where their offense wasn't necessarily clicking at a high level, where they were capable of winning games 17-14, which we know the Falcons aren't capable. I mentioned a stat on a recent podcast where basically the Falcons are incapable of winning any game unless they score at least 23 points in a game. So I think you do wonder if the Falcons defense can't live up to that caliber and be that type of team. If you have these, you know, low scoring games intermixed because your offense is so based on the run, is that going to be an issue? Certainly wasn't in Seattle, but it could be a bigger issue in Atlanta. But I wouldn't necessarily, you know, to wrap up my thoughts, I wouldn't necessarily say that Bevel's offense is going to slow us down. I just don't think it's going to be on the same level as, you know, some of these great innovators in the league, which is, you know, the new in vogue thing with Shanahan, McVay, or Reed or whatnot, you know, these offensive gurus. I think Bevel is a competent offensive coordinator. Like going back to the previous question where I talked about sort of, you know, sixes and sevens, I think he's a solid six. I think you could make a case that with Julio Jones and Matt Ryan, you know, more consistent quarterback play than he's gotten over most of his tenure. Remember, outside of those 2 years with Brett Favre, you know, he had like Gus Frerotte and Tavares Jackson. And he had a young Russell Wilson who was a very talented player, but wasn't necessarily a consistent, high level pocket passer, in those early days, in Seattle, which is why their offense was so predicated on the run, but that's a conversation for another day. So I think you can make an argument that with Matt Ryan, with Julio Jones, with improved offensive line, certainly better than some of the offensive lines he had in Seattle, certainly towards the end, that he could be a seven. But I don't think he's going to be an 8 or a 9 or a 10 like some of these other guys are. And that doesn't necessarily get people excited like I think, you know, people want to see. So that's more to me the knock on Bevel. Not that he's bad or anything. That he's just kind of like, oh, yeah, he's more of the same of what we've had for the most part, as I mentioned, for the last 20 years. Right? You know, he's not Shanahan. He's more Cutter. He's more Malarkey. He's more Sark, but he might be closer to the good versions of those guys than necessarily the bad ones. Now, we got more questions coming back on the back end of the show, but I do want to plug the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find a daily podcast devoted to all 30 NBA teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with my good buddy Brad Rowland. You find those wherever you get your Locked On podcast, your team every day. All right, EKB1 at First Flight Eli on Twitter asks, was thinking about this earlier today, but I have a bad feeling that Julio and Matt will retire in consecutive years. What do you think? You know, that's a possibility. Right now, I'm very confident Matt Ryan will play through the 2022 season. He'll be 37 at that point. My expectation is he'll play beyond that point, and he'll sort of reach a point similar to what Drew Brees reached a couple of years ago, where the Saints basically just give him a series of 1- and 2-year deals. To keep him playing, and that's how they do. And I suspect that the Falcons might wind up doing that for Matt Ryan, but who knows? You know, literally almost three to four years away. So much can change in that. Right now, I fully expect Julio Jones to play through the 2021 season. So, you know, if you have Julio Jones retire after 2021 and Matt Ryan then retires after 2022, you would be correct. But I don't think that's likely to happen because, again, I think Matt Ryan will probably play beyond 2022, you know, 2024, 2025 potentially, or longer than that, into his 40s potentially. I don't have that same amount of confidence for Julio Jones. I've expressed that a number of times on this podcast over the last 6 or so months. You know, he'll in 2021, he'll be 32. I think at that point in time, you can question whether or not the longevity of Julio Jones is going to continue beyond that. I think there's a possibility that he could. I think there's a possibility that he could retire. I don't know. I just personally, my whole take on the whole how long is Julio Jones going to play is, in my opinion, the Falcons were basically caught off guard by Roddy White falling off a cliff those last 2 years. And they weren't prepared for it, and I don't want to see the Falcons make the same mistake where they're not prepared for a life after Julio Jones and we have to go through, you know, years of overpaying number three wide receivers to basically be number two wide receivers because we're desperate for any sort of wide receiver help because we didn't plan for, you know, we didn't have somebody waiting in the wings to step up and replace Julio Jones to go alongside Calvin Ridley because we were mistakenly thought, oh, we're going to get like 5 years of Roddy White and Julio Jones playing together. We got two, really, if we're being honest, because the injuries sort of derailed the other three, or really the injuries also derailed Julio's rookie season, and Roddy White did not play particularly well. He led the league in drops in Julio's rookie season. So we really only got one good year out of those guys. And I think the expectation, oh, we're going to get 5 years out of Calvin Ridley and Julio Jones playing together, like, I don't know about that. Like, I'm hoping we can get three, which is more than what we got out of Roddy White and Julio Jones. But I think if you're counting on more than three, I think you're probably setting yourself up for disappointment. That's what I'm sitting here saying. Or at the very least, you should be prepared to only get three and plan to be like to move on. You know, I don't know. That's my thoughts on the whole situation, but we'll see how it plays out. So I don't really agree with you, but I can certainly understand, you know, why this is your nightmare, First Flight Eli. Our next question comes from Justin Sandu at Justin201224. He asks, what kind of 2019 season would lead to Dan Quinn being fired? Well, you know, basically no Falcons coach since Arthur Blank bought the team in 2002 has been able to survive two consecutive seasons without making a playoff appearance. So for the time being, I'm going to assume that that trend continues. So if Dan Quinn doesn't make the playoffs next year, then he's on the hot seat, potentially fire him. But that being said, you know, if they go 9-7 and lose on a tiebreaker, I don't necessarily see Blank firing him. So to answer this question, I would say probably the most plausible way is that the Falcons have a losing season, 7-9 or worse. And then I think, you know, I'm not at that point, I wouldn't be 100% convinced that Dan Quinn would survive that, but we'll have to see. It all depends on sort of the circumstances of the season. They go 7-9 because Julio Jones misses 11 games next year due to injury or something like that. I think that's a lot more forgivable than necessarily going 7-9 when you have a relatively healthy team and many of your superstars are healthy and able to play. All right, our last question comes from Tracy Edwards at Vic Tracy Ed. He asks, what are your thoughts on Schrader's decline? Do you think he's injured and will be back to his prior performance level when healthy? It just seems unlikely that he fell completely off this quickly without an underlying reason. Yeah, I think this is a good question. I do think he's injured. It's pure speculation on my part, but it doesn't seem like he's playing with the balance that he normally does, particularly when it comes to his right side, which I think is why he's been at times so susceptible to speed rushers this year that they're attacking his outside shoulder, because I think basically he's playing on one leg, because whether it's a hip, a knee, an ankle, or a foot, I think there's some injury in his right leg that doesn't allow him to have sort of the strength and support and balance in that leg that has led to some of his struggles. Whether or not he can bounce back, that is possible, but that is a toss-up at this point. Having gone through something similar with Roddy White back in 2014 and 2015, where in 2014, Roddy White had a major knee injury and really struggled in the first half of that season, had a little bit of a rebound in the second half, but still wasn't great. And then the thought process, okay, well, he'll be healthier in 2015 because he got healthier over the course of 2014, especially given 6 months of an offseason, and that wasn't the case. He was less of a player in 2015 than he was in for at least the second half of 2014. And I think the issue with those with Roddy was because he was 33 and 34 in those years, and you look at Schrader in contrast, who's 30, who will be, he's 30 now and will be 31 next season. The issue is the human body just doesn't recover as well at a certain point. You know, it's different with each individual, but, you know, the average number I've heard cited many times is the average person starts dying around the age of 27. And that statement comes from the fact that your body is not making as many cells. Your cells aren't reproducing. The number of cells that are being reproduced aren't outweighing the number of cells that are dying every day in your body. And so essentially, you know, that has everything to do with recovery. And so, you know, the case you would make for Schrader is that 31 isn't as nearly as big an issue, as big a number as age 34 was where it was with Roddy. So I think there's some hope there that Schrader could bounce back a little bit better than Roddy did. But, you know, if it is a joint issue that Schrader's dealing with, you know, he's having, you know, some issues with one of those joints in his legs, then being a 315-pound guy or whatever he is, probably isn't going to help him recover over the next 6 months as easily as it would if he was, you know, 250 pounds and had 50 less pounds of pressure on those joints. So I think it's plausible that Schrader could have a bounce back season in 2019 and play better, but I don't think it's automatic just because he's hurt, just because I think he's hurt. I think, you know, for me at least, and I've talked about this a number of times, I'm in favor of keeping Schrader, but it's not necessarily because of I believe that he's going to have this bounce back season and revert back to what he was pre-2018, which was, you know, a top 10 right tackle. It's more just due to the fact that I don't necessarily feel good about the alternative options for the Falcons. I think if they go in the free agent route, there's a limited number of choices. You have a guy like Trent Brown, who I think would be a good pickup, but I think he's probably going to be expensive because, again, I think he's going to want left tackle money. And left tackle, you know, you look at Jake Matthews, who's like a top two, top three paid left tackle. He makes like $15 million a year. You look at Ryan Schrader, who I think when he signed his deal was a top five right tackle paid, and he makes like, what, $6.5 million a year? So left tackles, essentially, the point I'm making is like they make twice as much as right tackles. And if you have to pay Trent Brown to be a left tackle, and you wind up getting into a bidding war because he's the top offensive tackle in the league, and other teams are being like, we're paying him at left tackle. We want him to be our left tackle, and the Falcons are paying him and be like, well, we want him to be our right tackle. And you're paying that guy $12 million a year and making him the highest paid or second highest paid right tackle in the league behind, like, say, Lane Johnson or whoever it is. I don't know if you're putting Trent Brown in a situation where he can live up to that contract. And so basically then you're going to wind up cutting him 2 or 3 years down the road because he's a good player, but not worth the money that you're paying him. And then you're right back at square one again, needing a right tackle. And then, you know, the option two for me is Juwan James, who is a good fit in the zone blocking scheme, but has a history of being injury prone. And so he's not a safe bet that if you sign him, he's going to be playing enough to be an upgrade over Schrader. Then I think your next best options in free agency are to go out there and sign another old veteran that's the same age or older than Ryan Schrader, who at best are going to be 1 year stopgaps. You know, someone like a Ty Nsekhe or Jared Veld here at that point. After those guys, I don't necessarily see anybody in free agency that is a clear upgrade over Schrader or what Schrader is this year. Maybe who knows if certain guys get cut who are cap cuts or whatever. But looking over the list of guys, nobody stood out to me the other day when I looked at it. Maybe Russell Okung, but I don't think he's going to get cut. So I think then your other alternative option is to go with a rookie. And I just think throwing a rookie to the Wolves generally isn't a great strategy, especially if you're hoping to get better play out of that guy than what you got out of Schrader, especially when you have guys like J.J. Watt and Cameron Jordan on the schedule, possibly Nick Bosa, possibly Ryan Kerrigan, depending on how the rest of the schedule plays out. So I just feel like you're throwing that rookie to the Wolves and you're kind of setting him up for failure. So for me, I personally think the path of easiest resistance is just to kind of keep Schrader, draft a guy. And that's the note. Like, it's not just keep Schrader and do nothing else. It's keep Schrader and draft somebody who can be his, you know, that can be groomed to replace him. If Schrader doesn't bounce back, then you have that rookie and you're basically like, well, we tried. We were optimistic that Schrader would bounce back. He didn't. So now we don't have a choice but to throw the rookie to the Wolves. But I don't think that should be your first option. You know, that's your plan B, not your plan A, in my opinion. So, you know, that's sort of why I'm in favor of keeping Schrader. It's not because I think, oh, you're going to get drastically improved play from him next season. I just think, you know, paying Schrader, you know, what, $7 million is probably the lesser evil. You know, it's the lesser question mark, I think, at the position. But we'll see what the Falcons do. I just think you cut him. There aren't that many great options, I don't think, that are going to make you feel good about that right tackle position. Maybe the Falcons find a way to secure one. There are, again, I listed a couple of guys that I would be more than content with. I just think you're going to be in a situation, you're opening the door potentially to be in a situation where you could think you solved the problem, but you didn't solve the problem. And it's even worse than what it was this past year. That's my concern with the whole situation. So we'll see how the Falcons play it. You know, there's been reports from, you know, people like Jeff Schultz of The Athletic that say that Schrader's likely safe, but it also does seem that if Ty Sambrello continues to outperform him over these next couple of games to finish out the season, then the Falcons will be like, wait, why are we paying Schrader all this money if our, you know, marginal backup swing tackle is outproducing him? So we'll have to see. You know, I have no idea at this point. So there you have it, guys. That's today's Q&A. Appreciate everybody for sending in their excellent questions. We'll be back on Monday with a rapid reaction to this Falcons-Panthers game, and we'll, you know, keep the thing going. I hope you guys have a happy holidays. I'll probably take Tuesday off, you know, just because it's Christmas. And unless something major happens on between now and Monday night, you know, over the weekend, that requires in-depth analysis beyond the Rapid Reaction podcast, then yeah, we'll probably take Monday night off. But yeah, at some point, we'll be back later in the week. I don't know. Sitting here today, I can't make any promises. But at the very least, I think I'm confident we'll give. I'll give you at least 3 shows next week, maybe 4, probably definitely not 5, but at least 3, potentially 4. So we'll see how. We'll play it by ear. Anyway, there you have it, guys. Until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.